Welcome, Hemant.
Thanks for having me.
We have a rather exciting topic to talk about, which is, can VCs actually solve long-term problems? But before we dive into that, I want to talk a little bit about General Catalyst, about yourself. The firm was founded in 2000. You joined shortly after, and then 3 years ago, you seemingly, without fanfare, without drama, took over leadership of the firm. We have a room full of LPs and VCs. Generational shifts is always a challenging topic. How did that all come together?
Yeah, we've been fortunate. I think this transition for us has been very seamless in a lot of ways. And one of the reasons was, so I've been with the firm for over 20 years. And when I moved to the Bay Area in 2011, David and Joel, who were the founders, basically said, you know, go build your own culture, what it's going to take to be successful in the Valley. And you know, also made me an owner in the firm. So they sort of did all the right things to incentivize the next generation. So that was one thing, which is, I think this was sort of a unique transition compared to others, where we kind of grew up building the business together. But the other reason this really worked was, I would say in hindsight, we weren't as intentional, but it worked out really well for us, is we brought in Ken Chenault to be our chairman when he was leaving American Express. This was in 2018. And I'll never forget this, because this was a very prescient comment from him. So we were having dinner in Cambridge. It was David, Joel, Ken, and me. And Ken basically said, I think I know why I'm here. I'm here to formally transition the firm from the two of you to him. And we didn't really fully appreciate what that meant. And then he said this other thing, which was, and I have to warn you, change is messy. And you just have to be patient in the way it's going to get done. In hindsight, it wasn't so difficult for us, but I think just having somebody who understands how to build enduring companies, which part of it is leadership transitions, was, you know, very helpful for us to be able to do this successfully.
I mean, you just mentioned Ken is the chairman. You're the CEO of GC, which is not a common title amongst VCs. You've also talked in your shareholder letters about how you're trying to transform the firm from a partnership to an enduring company. Can you just explain a little bit what that means, both, you know, at the philosophical level, but frankly, also just on a day-to-day level? What does that mean?
Yeah, so I think it all stems from what is our purpose? What are we really trying to do at General Catalyst? And in 2018, when Ken joined, 18 years into the existence of the firm, we actually did a mission and values work. And unlike most companies that do it at the beginning, for us, this was really about self-discovery over the last 18 years, who we are. And we ended up saying our mission is to invest in positive, powerful change that endures. And well, if we're going to help build companies that can endure, then we had to learn how to endure ourselves. And so I think this is where we, you know, went down this intentional path, saying, what does it take to build an enduring technology investment firm? And I think that's where, you know, there's this tension, because unlike other companies, you have this interesting tension in building a investment firm that can be an institution, where somehow, if your core is venture capital, somehow you have to maintain that artisanal sit around the table, look around sort of corners that are not obvious as to how the world's going to go, and make those investments. But then on one side, which is very creative, you know, we're in LA, so we can sort of very studio-like. Then on the other side, you have to run with the rigor of an operating company, because we have, you know, over 200 people now, and all the things around talent development, sort of long-term product roadmap have to all be executed like some of our portfolio companies do. So a lot of our journey has been, what is that culture? What is that sort of first principles culture that allows you to build a business in the industry which has venture capital at its core? So that's a lot of where I spend my time thinking about.
Can you maybe shed a little light on kind of what's coming up maybe in the next 5 to 10 years in terms of General Catalyst, the firm? I mean, you recently bought La Famiglia in Europe. You've talked a lot about going into India, et cetera, like 3,200 people. How are you thinking that might evolve over the next?
Yeah, so again, it goes back to what is it that we're trying to accomplish? What we're trying to accomplish is using technology to not only innovate, but also transform society, especially in this cycle where we're headed down the use of artificial intelligence. That to me is a massive opportunity. And I think our view in venture used to be back great founders, be serendipitous, take those companies public, and then trade hands with investors, our learning has been, well, we can play an even greater role and we can be a lot more intentional. So the way I think about our work evolving is like sort of maintain that early stage core, sort of keep incubating companies, which you do a lot, keep investing in companies at the earliest stages, but then work with those founders to strive towards transformations that are more industry oriented. And that forces you to think about radical collaboration, that forces you to think about responsible innovation, that forces you to think about how do you build bridges with the rest of society and the different stakeholders. And so the evolution of our firm is very much on, if we want to be truly ambitious and drive these transformations, then what are all the capabilities we need to develop in the firm to be able to do that? And again, as I said, while protecting our core, which is the thing I spend most of my time is making sure that ability to back founders and ambiguous ideas is what we get up in the morning to do first and foremost as a firm.
Maybe speaking of incubations, you were behind Livongo, arguably one of the most successful venture-backed healthcare companies. But you've also said publicly that you didn't think that company ultimately achieved the impact it could have when it comes to patient access, patient outcomes, et cetera. We've obviously just come off a downturn in the market. There were a lot of dollars that did go into healthcare, a lot of which didn't perform anywhere near as well as Livongo. You seem to be doubling down in healthcare. Why and how do you think about actually trying to build an even more impactful healthcare company?
Yeah, look, we have a deep belief that now is the time that this industry will change. COVID showed us we don't have a choice. It was a huge market failure. But I also think the confluence of the way technologies are developing, the difficulties systems, health systems are having, it's the general trend where payers and providers are all converging. So you're sort of having these payvider models where everybody's headed. I mean, the biggest insurance company, UnitedHealth, if you talk to them, they think, they're already 55% of the revenues from Optum. And if you think about by 2030, it's going to be 70, 75%. So they're essentially becoming a provider as well that takes risk. And so we believe the trends are here. And the question is, will the scaled players be able to capture the value, or can you create a new ecosystem of companies that can get there? The reason I said what I said on Livongo, which look, we as a financial return, it was great. We started in 2013, 2014. We took it public in 2019, grew to about $500 million business, and exited at the peak for about $18 billion. And if I had to go back again, I probably would have that same tension again, because you always have to think about the economic return for your investors. But we only served 500,000 out of 35 million people with chronic conditions in the US. We were just getting going. And then we had built the first go-to-market channel with Fortune 500 companies. We've built this relationship. We're managing a meaningful percentage of their population. And that whole employer base needs to rethink how they manage healthcare for their employees. Well, we could have done a lot with it if we still held it. Mm-hmm. So, and there's ups and downs in stock markets, but if you had a 20-year horizon, and you're serving, 10 million patients, you would have a business that's doing $15 billion. Put any multiple on it, and we would have done really well for our investors and had much greater impact. So that's been a forcing function to think about how do we really do work at greater scale in this industry, because too many point solutions, we have learned how to create those exits, but it's not going to change the industry. And I think the real value is going to get created if we can actually stand up, and I've written this in my book, 10 or 12 companies that are at scale, that are modern, technology-enabled, and drive what we think are the principles of health assurance, proactive, affordable, and accessible as an ecosystem. And so we're doubling down because we believe that kind of value can be created here. And, there's early evidence that we have some companies that are on that kind of a path. Not to be naive about all the inertia in this space, but I do think it's possible.
You mentioned 20 years. Obviously, venture firms are typically, 10, 12-ish. Like, is that what it takes to build a very large and enduring healthcare company? Are there different types of, whether delivering services versus just pure software, if that's even doable in healthcare?
I think that's what it takes to build any very large company. I mean, our first investment in Stripe was in 2010. And, we led their round in 2020, and we wrote a very large check in their last financing they did as well. So, and that'll tell you we have a 20-year hold on that business. Yep. If we're entering today, that's the way we're thinking. So look, the very best companies, you know, they're responsible and they compound for a long time. And my theory is because they're responsible. And so I think sort of learning how to be technology investors that can play that trend wherever possible is you know, something we think a lot about.
And are you thinking about healthcare and health insurance mainly focused on the US, or would, now that especially you're more active in Europe or elsewhere, would you want to do that anywhere else?
Yeah, we are starting to do stuff in Europe and India. Europe because Chris Bischoff, who co-leads our healthcare practice, is based there and he actually knows the market. I don't understand the European healthcare system. I don't pretend to, and I don't, you know, I sort of trust his judgment on that. India, I am slowly getting smart about it, and we've done a few things. And my motivation there is it's at the formative stages, and I think what we can bring to the Indian entrepreneurs is what not to do. All the misalignment that got created in the healthcare sector here, so we're trying to sort of indoctrinate that entrepreneurial ecosystem with, you know, designing a system that over the longer term is more aligned economically. So you don't create this whole who pays and who benefits are two different stakeholders, and you just don't have an economically rational system. That's what we're trying to unwind here, you know, in some ways.
You used the word ecosystem a couple of times in healthcare. You guys, I think at this point, have partnered with 20 or so large health systems or hospitals. Can you maybe just share a little bit, what does that mean? I mean, these are not typically the kind of organizations that, you know, are particularly fast moving or working with VCs or startups.
Yeah, so, you know, my core insight that I always think about in terms of what made Livongo successful was you got a tech person like me and a healthcare entrepreneur like Glenn Tolman teaming up. So all the work we've done in healthcare, the partnerships, the way we've started companies has been all based on this idea of radical collaboration. So culturally from the beginning, you can have technology in healthcare in the roots, as opposed to being tech first and not fully appreciating the market, or being market first and not fully appreciating the technology. And I think that's an easier said than done thing to build that kind of a hybrid culture. So that is what the core philosophy has been with which we've approached it. And the reason is because otherwise you end up creating point solutions in the industry. One of the reasons you don't have such big outcomes in this industry is because it's hard to build companies in a problem that is so big that can scale on their own. So our thesis is, well, if you build a lot of these companies and drive collaboration between them so that collectively they're driving the workforce transformation, the movement to proactive care, value-based care, and then also driving automation and profitability in these systems, there's no single company that can drive, those are complex levers. So for us, it's important that our companies that we're building now work together in trying to drive those. And that's where a lot of our focus and attention is. And it's a very hard problem, but you know, luckily we've chosen to work with a lot of founders that know that this problem is bigger than them. And they have to approach it with the mindset that if the mission is bigger than theirs, then they must collaborate.
Can we then talk a little bit about, you recently announced your intent to acquire a health system in Ohio, you know, 130-year-old health system called SUMA, was a specialized vehicle or a company called Health Insurance Transformation Co. Certainly a lot of people have commented on that, both around how different and bold the strategy is, but also, you know, is this venture? Isn't this more like private equity, which certainly I think many of us know have had a checkered history with consolidation in healthcare. What is the thinking here? What's the strategy here?
Yeah, first of all, if we were going to go buy a health system, we have to do right by that community because it's people's lives on the other side. So the horizon you have to think about to be able to do that has to be much, much longer than venture or private equity. So first thing is it's not venture or private equity because of that, because that otherwise you'd be doing wrong by, you know, those people that need the care in the community. Second thing I would say is it's definitely not PE, because PE model is take cost out and drive financial return. And our model here is to actually put innovation in and drive a transformation. And then I would say, you know, it is bold, but I frankly don't know how else to create a model where that ecosystem of companies that I referenced earlier can be activated to drive that transformation. Our hope is that we have a like-minded community that and the leadership in Suma that wants to do this work, and that'll become ground zero for what we can then show to all of our health system partners and then beyond on how they ought to think about, you know, that sort of transformation that needs to be driven. So it's a very long game, but having an actual environment that's a full IDN that's not on the coast, so it's truly representative of the country. And so it's a generalizable problem. If we can solve it there, then we'll be able to, bring it to others.
And how would that work in terms of, you know, at GC, like, how do you form teams to sort of work on this? You know, is it just, hey, look, we have a lot of healthcare portfolio companies. Let me make sure I introduce you and help you get into the right person. Or is there more that you're doing even on the operational side with this, you know, hopefully health system acquisition?
Yeah. So two things. It's first of all, it's set up as a separate company that we own in GC. It's not a portfolio company. It's set up as a separate company. It's run by Mark Harrison, who was the CEO of Intermountain Health. I chair it. And the way it works is the mandate is to focus on health systems of the customers as opposed to being a vendor to our companies. And just yesterday, we were mapping out, we have a full day with some of our portfolio companies that we think are the early part of that ecosystem. And we're literally designing out what would it take to bring these five or six solutions together and sort of bring them in into our health system partners, including Suma we would own, but we have 20 others, as we mentioned, to drive those sort of, you know, transformation levers around proactive care and profitability. We call this a flywheel between our venture capital business and HATCO, where we learn from HATCO and the engagement with the systems and what the problems are. That learning can lead to us incubating new companies or investing in helping other founders. And then what we're building there, we bring to them to say, hey, look, here's what's working in the industry and think about that as a way to solve problems. But that flywheel has to sort of be capitalistic. It can't be that we're going to force these systems to use our companies if they're not the best companies. And so that's why the mindset of the team that runs HATCO is very much the customer is these systems and the goal is their transformation.
We'd love to touch a little bit on AI in healthcare. Obviously, big buzzword these days, but lots of change happening. Again, wouldn't generally think of large health systems, let's say, as the first adopters of AI, but what are you actually seeing on the front lines since you work with all these health systems?
Yeah, so first of all, everything's going to be AI, just like everything became mobile. So we're just in this early phases. A lot of our companies, you know, Camure, Leighton, and others are deeply using the language models in different set of applications. We did get a lot of calls when ChatGPT was announced from a bunch of health system CEOs saying, how should we think about adopting this in the industry? And so we thought a lot about it. We decided we were going to build a language model that was bespoke for this industry, obviously leveraging a lot of the work that's being done by OpenAI and others, Mistral and others. And so today, within a year of launching that, we have 38 health systems, or 40 now, that have contributed their data and are going to be leveraging that in terms of their own transformation with AI. And our commitment to them is we'll sort of hand over in some ways the constitution to you on which applications is this technology ready for. So you'll start, you know, sort of around administrative functions or easy sort of workflows that are on the phone, and over time think about how do you do actual diagnostics. And then the other thing is there's some places where AI should be the pilot and humans co-pilot, and then there's places where, you know, from a safety and efficacy perspective, like clinical decisions, humans should be the pilot and AI should be the co-pilot, at least for the foreseeable future. And so just having the right set of principles, and we've been building this company Hippocratic, where we're going to be launching these solutions in short order, and wouldn't be possible, again, if we didn't have that kind of a collaboration with these systems, get their proprietary data and their guidance and using their nurses as RLHF to make sure we're training these things to be as good or better than the workforce.
If I remember correctly, you started talking about or forming a thesis around health insurance back in 2018 or 2019. Love to hear a little bit about what are the next set of, you know, enduring long-term problems you're mapping out, you're thinking about trying to tackle.
Yeah, I think, you know, at our firm, there are probably two big trends. One is a technological shift around AI and how does that become a transformative force. So we've decided not to invest too much at the Big Bang language model layer and focus much more on, well, how do these models interface with different verticals? So what are the modern vertical SaaS companies going to look like, and what are the model vertical business function companies going to look like? So we're actually incubating a bunch and looking for working with founders there. So that's one. And I think there's a, that's sort of a, to me, a 15-20-year roadmap around transformation with AI. The second is the geopolitical shift, right? I mean, as you think about what we went through with pandemic and Ukraine and all the issues around energy and climate over the last few years that have become more pronounced, nations are thinking about, there's a set of critical industries, it's defense, it's climate, it's manufacturing and industrials, your healthcare is a critical industry, where they want to have companies get built which are sovereign first, global second, meaning these nations are going to want to make sure they can control their destiny. No one wants to rely on the United States for the next vaccine. So can we have our own manufacturing capacity around that, production capacity around that, as an example? So that is a pretty seismic shift that I've written about around this sort of re-globalization trend. And so resiliency, at a sovereign level in these critical industries requires its own transformation of supply chains and how these companies get built. And so we've been investing pretty actively in that as well. I think these are both, to me, 20-year trends. And inside of resilience, I'm trying to figure out climate again. I have a lot of scars on my back from climate 1.0. But I'm jumping back in, and we're starting to do stuff there and figuring out how capitalism can actually work in that industry. There's a lot of do-gooder work there, but unless we can show that capital can drive return in that industry, we're not going to solve this problem. So we're thinking a lot from first principles about how do we really take the moonshots, how do we really think about rollout of infrastructure at scale, and which industries are ready for us to lean into to drive that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again, Hemant, for coming. Lots more to talk about, maybe next time, next year. Once again, thank you all.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.